Great. Okay. What we do is hold these sessions every 2 weeks, and they're just kind of informal conversations. So we talk about brownfields and environmental projects.
Mary Vogel.
Brian Doherty.
Mary, how are you?
Hi.
And who else joined?
Brian Doherty.
Both from
Brian,
Boston.
Okay. Boston, okay. We've got people from Boston and San Francisco.
I've been on the calls every 2 weeks. I've been listening, and I'm just quiet usually, you know, just listening.
That's good. This is, and who was that speaking, Mary?
Lena,
okay. We like to have informal conversations about setting up these job training programs. In about 2 weeks, we've anticipated this since November, EPA is going to be issuing a request for proposals for the next round of EPA environmental job training programs. These are the $300,000 grants. The reason that they seem to be delaying is when they planned their grant cycle, they have what they call assessment pilots. There's different kinds of cleanup grants. There's some that are what they call assessment grants that determine how much pollution there is out there, where the brownfields might be. And then there's revolving loan funds, and there's cleanup funds, and then there's also someone just joined? Yes. Excuse me? Okay. We're having trouble hearing you, but that's okay. If you can hear us, fine. If you can't, then you might want to dial in again. Excuse me? No? Can anyone else hear? No.
No, it's hard to hear.
Are you on a speakerphone? If you're on a speaker, if you're on a speakerphone, maybe just get on the regular phone or try another connection. That'd be great.
Can you hear me now?
That's a little better. Might have to talk real loud, but we'll continue. If you could hear us.
I can hear you well.
Okay. You may want to try calling back in on a regular phone. If you can, maybe we just have a bad connection. As we get closer to this RFP being issued, one of the things I was indicating was they have been delaying this RFP. But the reason, and it's a logical reason, and it's not anything unusual, they have limited grant review people in EPA in Office of Solid Waste Emergency Response. And recently they've got four other grant programs, and they asked for grant proposals from those entities, and they were due in November. And what happened was that was about the same time that this RFP was supposed to be issued. So basically what happens, they got snowed under, and they just got a whole lot of grants to review, and they're trying to review several other grants. And our grant proposal program is ready to go. It's being reviewed. It's been, I think it's pretty much finalized, but it's in the internal review process. So they've been delaying it. It was November, and then it was early December, and then now it's going to be issued in January. We have these calls throughout the year every couple of weeks, and we've been talking about things in general. As soon as this RFP is issued, we'll get very specific in terms of writing proposals to this grant request process. But what we want to do now is think about things that we could do in general in terms of before this comes out. Now, one thing that I would suggest to those of you who have not or may not be familiar with the EPA grant proposals, if they're fairly similar each year, and if you want to get a head start, you might go to grants.gov, and one of the things we do besides recording these sessions is we also have post-session notes. So I'll send you all some post-session notes, and I'll put it in the notes. Someone just joined?
Yeah, hi. My name is Andy.
Oh, Andy. Okay. Andy. We're just indicating we also have these post-session notes, and we'll put the website, if you're not familiar with grants.gov, that's where the RFP would be posted. And If you get a copy of last year's request for proposal, it will be similar to last year's in structure. Will have some slight differences in terms of the things they'll be emphasizing. What happened last year, originally this program was fairly well restricted to work in brownfields, on brownfield sites, and it's slowly been expanding, and Office of Air and Office of Water have been getting a little more interested in it. And I think we understand that they'll probably be contributing to the program, and they'll probably be allowing and maybe even promoting some programs in terms of water and wastewater. We'd want to wait till we get the specifics on that, but that'll probably be the main difference. Otherwise, this grant request will be very, very similar to the way it has been in past years. And what makes this grant a little different than other federal grants are the following. One of the problems with us on the receiving side of grants have with this is it doesn't cover indirect costs. It'll cover all direct costs, things that are specifically involved with training your environmental workers. Some grants will give you broad grants that allow you to do a whole lot of things in terms of life skill training, in terms of stipends and things like that. And this particular grant does not allow that. In fact, when you go to last year's RFP, it very specifically tells you what you can't do with it. They don't allow you to do things like actual work. You can't conduct site assessments. You can't do cleanup activities. You can't do life skills education, though, like remedial math classes and things like that. You can't provide stipends to students, for example, that type of thing. What you can do is pay for anything directly involved in this environmental training and then the peripheral courses that are required to do these environmental jobs. And the reason I mention that is it's something to keep in mind as you're developing your program. And one of the things we wanted to talk about today was some of these general things between now and when the RFP comes out that you may want to consider. And I think that when Elena first got on the call, she hit a note that is quite interesting. Elena, you were talking about some projects in San Francisco that are going on in your community. Did you want to repeat some of those things that are going on?
Oh, sure. Well, we have the shipyard, the cleanup of the Hunters Point shipyard, which is a multi-billion dollar project, and they're putting in a whole, you know, it's the only place left in San Francisco to develop, and that's on two Superfund sites. And then the other thing is they're rebuilding the whole residential sewer system, which is a $4.6 billion project over the next 20 years. And that's, you know, the waste, it processes the wastewater and the sewage for not only San Francisco County but two surrounding counties. In addition to that, what I found was interesting was that five of the largest solar panel producers are located right here in the Bayview Hunters Point shipyards, too. So a lot of the new kind of green economy stuff and the new way we're going to have to start dealing with, you know, cities and pollution and that sort of thing is going on right here in San Francisco and Bayview Hunters Point. So we're just trying to get ready for that.
Bayview, to give you a background, I visited and toured the Bayview Hunters Point shipyard about 8 years ago. This has been a very long project. This is where Bayview Hunters Point was a shipyard. Actually, is where the Gomar Explorer was. This is Howard Hughes' massive ship. It was a spy ship that went out and, I think, retrieved Soviet submarines and things like that. It's a huge shipyard, but it's the incredible thing, and Lena will probably concur, it's probably the most prime real estate in San Francisco right now. It overlooks the bay and beautiful, beautiful point views. But the interesting thing is when the shipyard went in, and this is a very, very classic example, you had property that was right on the bay. Industry came in this case it was the Navy, the government came in, built these shipyards. They let the neighborhood deteriorate. They did not invest in the neighborhood. They brought people in with good-paying jobs from other places, not the neighborhood. This has happened in Cleveland and other. Sometimes it happens with foundries. In the case of Cleveland, it might have been a large foundry. The people who benefited came from not the immediate community, but afar. Sometimes, and I don't think it was necessarily the case in Hunter's Point, the community was polluted. It happens often, and there are places in New York with scrapyards and different types of junkyards and things where the community gets polluted, and the people don't have an opportunity to participate in the economic activity of that point. So the neighborhood deteriorates. And then on top of that, the place that is active, in this case the shipyard or the foundry in the case of Cleveland, pollutes everything in on the site. And it becomes perhaps a superfund or many superfunds or at least the brownfields. And then now we have an issue and we have to clean it up. And several things also occur. When the cleanup occurs, people come from afar again, the same different people, but instead of, again, using the people in the community who have not been taking advantage of the economic development of the original shipyard, they're not used to do the cleanup. They bring in consultants and companies from afar. They get the economic benefit of the cleanup while the community doesn't. And then the worst part of this whole process is they clean up the shipyard, and in the case of Bayview, Hunter's Point, it could end up as being gentrified and being one of the most expensive communities in the San Francisco area. And then the people who live there, who were kind of victimized all those years, could get victimized again. They were pushed out, kind of in the similar to the Harlem type situation. So we've got this community victimization that may occur five or six times and over again. Now, the interesting thing, and maybe Lena could expand on that, is Bayview Hunter's Point are sensitive to what I just described, and I think that they're doing a whole lot to avoid these kind of mistakes. I understand they're being very sensitive about how this is going to be redeveloped. And they're going to make sure that people, the indigenous population of the community, are not necessarily pushed out. Are you familiar with that at
no,
all?
No, that's not true. Yes, I'm very
really?
Familiar with that. No, that's absolutely not true. What it used to be, so the African American population, which was you know primarily in Bayview Hunter's Point, is now down to from 10 years, just 10 years ago, about 10% to now 4%. I mean, it's people are being pushed out in so many ways. It would make you sick to your stomach. I mean, it's a horrible. I can't even find the right words for it. It's a horrible, horrible situation right now. We're in a position where we're just trying to make the best, you know, out of a bad situation, kind of the best we can. But no, there's not a whole lot of sensitivity. There's talk. There's very little talk around it, but there's very little that's being done. Like I said, the African American population is dwindling down to nothing, and you're absolutely right. It's prime real estate, and basically, kind of the dynamic is just to show, well, you know, all of you guys are dysfunctional and can't really get it together, and we're bending over backwards to try to make things work for you. But, you know, but there's a whole lot of middlemen kind of taking up all the money in between that's supposed to go to the community to get them ready for it. So,
I'm sad to hear this. That's very interesting what you say, because 8 years ago they had all these wonderful plans when they wanted to do this. They're touting how they're going to share how the community is going to participate. And now when the rubber meets the road, it sounds like it's quite different.
Well, no, San Francisco is prime real estate. As you know, it's one of the most expensive places to live in the world. And ain't no way that they're going to have a bunch of people living in public housing, you know, who's going to be living on that prime real estate. They got to do it a little bit, but I mean, it's just, you know how it is. It's about money right now. And right now, that's the only place that there's money in San Francisco. It's the development of that, the PUC projects, which is there, you know. But just like you said, the power plants, all that stuff is right there in Bayview Hunters Point. We have the highest rates of cancer, eczema, asthma in the country. So we're trying to figure this out because we know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You went through what I just described, didn't you? I mean, you basically lived that story.
Absolutely.
You know, you're not alone. Camden, New Jersey is another example. Now, we're talking about your site specifically, but the interesting thing for those other people on the call and those who will be listening to this, this is a story that's repeated over and over, and it's hard to believe that that would be the case today, but it appears to be the reality.
Yeah.
Now, the question we have to ask ourselves, and this is one of the wonderful things, or one of the positive things, unfortunately our program isn't very big, it's one of the possibilities that this program can bring, is the purpose of the Environmental Job Training Program and Environmental Justice Movement, which is small and too small, is let's find jobs, train the people in the community who have previously been victimized. Let's try to get them good jobs. Let's let them participate in the economic redevelopment of this place. Bayview Hunters Point is probably it's probably the epitome of this case because it was beautiful land turned into terrible land, victimized the people in the community, and now it's going to be beautiful land again with this redevelopment. You've got the stadium right down the road. You've got, all this real estate that's going to be cleaned up. There are going to be thousands and thousands of jobs out there. Now, the question is, and this happens in every community, probably to a smaller extent than in San Francisco, how do we participate and get into that? And this is exactly what we want to be thinking about now with our Brownfields job development programs between now and when this RFP comes out. And as it comes out, we're going to want to describe other communities, whether it's St. Louis or it's Boston. They have similar situations, maybe not to the extent of San Francisco. Now, the interesting thing for those of you from Boston and those of you from San Francisco, in both these cases, we've got strong organized labor. Now, in your more industrialized and southern states, we may not have that issue of having good, strong organized labor, which we can work with. It's actually a better situation to have organized strong labor that works with the Brownfields program than perhaps to work with a lot of dispersed programs that it's harder to deal with. But we may want to start looking at these PSAs or PLAs, the project stabilization agreements or project labor agreements. Are any of you familiar with those?
Yeah. In Boston, we are very familiar with them.
Okay.
In fact, we just, the pre-apprenticeship program that we're running now was established pursuant to a project labor agreement between the building trades and a major retrofit contractor working at the Boston Housing Authority. So a project labor agreement is a labor agreement that's specific to a particular project. And what's happening now is that many times these agreements have provisions in there for hiring residents, women, and people of color. The Boston one we have, because it's BHA, they have hiring requirements anyway. But we recently negotiated a project labor agreement for $750 million worth of construction at UMass Boston, and that agreement has a provision that they will adhere to the Boston plan for hiring, which has those requirements for women, residents, and people of color.
Okay. So basically what we're saying is, and some call them PSAs, PLAs, and I'm going to include in the notes here what has been done in Los Angeles on some projects with PLAs. And the trick is, and basically it is, it's an agreement between usually the developer or owner of the property and the organized labor organizations that will be involved. And it sounds like yours is kind of similar. Yours is between the contractor and the organized labor organizations. But it says, and it's give and take on both sides, that this is what the organized labor group will do and not do, and this is what the contractor will do and not do. And so it's good for everyone because it allows for more certainty, and the reasons the developers like it is it keeps perhaps having a strike or a work interruption from occurring, so they can have certainty in terms of the project. It can be very good for the community in that it is a chance to hire local. Now, I guess the question, and here's, in San Francisco, this is something you may want to look into. Can you get a PLA or get into an existing PLA? And there probably will be some sort of PLA. And the next question is, can you do it to include your graduates? And if you can develop some wording in there, and sometimes the best wording in any agreement is a very short sentence, one or two lines, that says, in your case, disadvantaged veterans and graduates of an environmental training program. And those six words could be golden for you for years to come. In other words, if you could get into that agreement and just put a few words in. Now, granted, you may not have a program yet, but if you could get the words in, when you're writing your grant, you can put these, you could make this the center point of your grant, that you've got a PLA or a PSA that will hire your graduates. And one of the whole reason for these grants are to put people in jobs and to train them in the environmental arena and to get them jobs. Now, if you could demonstrate that you've established a PLA or you're included in a PLA, it would hold tremendous resonance in terms of your grant application and your placement portion of your project. Do you think that this is totally not possible in Boston to do something like that, or do you think that there is a possibility of getting into the PLA?
Well, we already have a PLA for our project. It wouldn't necessarily, we'd have to look at going forward, if we get funding under this program, what sort of connections to make, because the PLA we have doesn't say specifically environmental, you know, workers.
Right.
But
right.
It does, we have a PLA with a memorandum of understanding with the trade about placing graduates from our apprenticeship, our pre-apprenticeship program.
That's very strong.
Currently.
Yeah, and that's good. That's strong. And Lena, you may want to look at that in the San Francisco area to the extent that Hunters Bay Point will be organized labor because it's a federal program. There may be some peripheral projects that aren't, but it sounds like you'll be working closely with organized labor. Is that the read you're taking now, or is that the way you see it?
Well, we are positioned to be able to do that, so it's just a matter of having something, you know, to bring to the table and negotiate, you know, but
right.
Our agency is in a good place and you know, politically and so on
right.
and so forth. So I think that, you know, as long as I have the idea about doing that, you know, it will be a possibility.
Yeah, you can.
So I'm glad you said that.
You know, a lot of the PLAs bring people. The beautiful thing about a PLA is often it will require the organized labor, the trades, to bring in apprentices. You know, from those, whether it's disadvantaged veterans, it requires them to bring them into the apprenticeship program, which is a wonderful way of getting your graduates into some programs, you know. So to the extent that you can do that. Now, one of the interesting things, and Liam Tram from Boston wrote me an email last week. He said, does it count to if your graduates from your job training program get apprenticeships? And I wrote to Joe Bruss, who was the EPA Brownfields coordinator in EPA headquarters. He's in charge of this program. And I asked him, I said specifically, we got a question. Does it count as a job placement when someone goes into apprenticeship program? And his response was, it counts if they get paid, if they're getting paid. So this is one potential issue we may have to work around somehow, or we're going to have to get some sort of allowance or clarification from EPA, because his feeling at EPA was they would count it as a placement if you train someone and then they go into a job to get some sort of pay. Now, I guess the question is, if the apprenticeship includes some sort of pay, then that would count as a job.
Is a paid on, you get paid because it's a combination of both classroom and on the job training. So they go into classroom initially, but part of it is a requirement to have on the job training. In fact, there are more hours of on the job training than there are classroom hours required. So, and you get paid as an apprentice, which is a percentage of the journey worker's rate while you're in your apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So yes, and you are getting paid, and it's a job.
Yeah, so that is a job. It is that would be a job, and it's counted. One of the big criteria of the EPA job training program is you place 70% or so of your graduates, and that would be, you know, you would be placing them in a job. So I think you may have to make that clear in your proposal that this is our paid jobs. So,
we've had a problem in the past with even the state agency that we have our grant from now, to really help them understand what an apprenticeship is and that it is, in fact, a placement. And now they've learned, but is a learning curve for these agencies about an apprenticeship and what that means in terms of a, you know, so-called job placement.
And we may have to, on a national level, educate EPA to make sure that they're aware that apprenticeships are paid positions, and so that they don't, that any grant reviewers fully understand that these are placements, and they're actually good placements because it leads to permanent employment once they get brought into the program. So it really is a positive thing. So
can I ask you a question? You asked about you said no stipends and no life skills education. Could we do that with matching funds?
Yes. In fact, one of the There's a very specific reason that these programs are not big programs. They used to be $200,000 programs, now they're $300,000. EPA, when they started this, wanted this to be a leveraged program. They did not, politically, there was a lot of, and there still is, why are you doing this in EPA? Why isn't it a Department of Labor program? And of course, EPA said, well, this is very technical. It's specific to environmental jobs, and we're not, it's not necessarily a Department of Labor jobs program as much as it is a training specific skills to get people into environmental employment and also help the environment. So there's a slight difference here. So what EPA wanted to do is they wanted to force people to partner and to leverage. And in fact, you're going to have to partner and leverage to get the grant. They're going to be looking at your partners and how you're going to be leveraging funds. Now, you could leverage in a lot of ways. Leveraging doesn't, it could be matching dollars, but it could be in kind, and in kind can be major. We're talking about community colleges. When you're linked into a community college program, you're leveraging a huge number of resources. When you're linked into a WIB, you might get matching funds from them. There might be some local community organizations or local governmental organizations. And in January, we're going to go over these very specific issues of leveraging. But in writing your grant, it will be a big part of it. One of the things you may want to do between now and the next time we talk, or as we go forward, is look at leveraging partners that may be out there. And I'm not just talking about let's find out people who have money, because a lot of people don't have money. They may have other things. You could get free life skills training. You could get free physicals from Department of Health. You could get free, we've got grantees getting free transportation from the Department of Transportation. We get free facilities from the community colleges and trainers. We link up with organized labor, and we get free training facilities. We get free instructors, fit-up suits. There is a, you could leverage almost everything in kind from different organizations that already have things going on. So what you may want to think about, and you're going to want to do this for your grant, is who's out there that you could partner with. And I'm not talking about financial partners. I'm talking about MOUs, people who can help your program contribute. You'd be amazed at people who might give you facilities or instructors or equipment or some technical assistance, that type of thing. So you'll want to look at that. And those things that EPA doesn't allow you to do are not big issues. You can get those from other places, Department of Labor, one-stops, WIBs, and that type of thing. So, well, one of the things we do promise people, we don't keep these over 30 minutes. So we're going to be talking. Our next one is going to be January 11th. We're going to take a holiday break here. And I'll send out post-session notes on this. And then we'll have another call on Wednesday, the 11th of January, and we'll go every 2 weeks. And of course, by that time, we may have clarity, or the RFP may have been issued. My feeling is it'll probably be issued about somewhere between the 11th and the 25th of January, unless they get slowed down some more. But we got lots we could do before that time. So why don't you all have a good holiday, and we'll see you back here on the 11th of January, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Okay. Talk to you soon. Bye.